This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Well, the night sky for June 2012. To be totally honest, it's not dark for very long. And in Scotland, for example, it never really gets truly dark. Perhaps it's a good thing that the main highlight this month is in daytime. Well, let's look at the sky first. Well, when it finally does get dark, if you can stay up that late, you'll find that Leo is setting towards the west. It has the planet Mars lying below it, moving in fact across into Virgo. The brightest star you'll see just to the west of south is the star Arcturus in the constellation of Bootes. Just to the left of that is a rather nice circlet of stars called Corona Borealis, the northern crown. And then we come to the constellation of Hercules. The four brightest stars make up what is called the Keystone. And if you look up the right-hand side, about two-thirds of the way up from the bottom of the Keystone, you should see a little fuzzy object with binoculars. And a telescope will show you that it's the globular cluster M13, probably the best that we can see in the northern sky. Coming further over, we begin to see the stars that make up our summer constellations. First of all, you'll see a bright star, Vega, in the constellation, small one, of Lyra the Lyre. Across from that, rising in the east, is Deneb, the brightest star of Cygnus the Swan. And below them, fairly low as it rises, is the star Altair in Aquila. And those three bright stars make up what is called the summer triangle. If you sweep upwards from Altair towards Vega, about a third of the way, with a pair of binoculars, you should come across a rather nice little asterism, Brocky's cluster, or the coat hanger. It looks like an upside-down coat hanger. And remember, if you go up towards the zenith from Arcturus, you'll come to that rather lovely constellation Ursa Major. Of course, the part that we know best is the plough. The central one of the handle is, in fact, Mizar. And if you look at that with binoculars, you should see it's a double star. The secondary star nearby is called Alcor. And a small telescope will show that, in fact, Mizar is itself a double star. And remember, of course, that Merak and Dupe, the right-hand stars of the plough, are the pointers pointing up towards Polaris. So, what of the planets? Well, let's start with Jupiter. It passed behind the Sun on May the 13th. That's called Superior Conjunction. So, following that, you then see it in the pre-dawn sky. At about the beginning of June, it rises about 45 minutes before dawn. And you could glimpse it with binoculars just above the eastern horizon at magnitude minus 2. As the month progresses, it rises earlier, so at the very end of June, it actually rises 2 hours before the Sun. So if you don't mind getting up very early, that's the time to actually observe it. It's about 34 arc seconds in diameter. The actual angular size doesn't vary an awful lot as the Earth goes around the Sun, because it's a fair way away. And it's lying between the Hyades and the Pleiades in the constellation of Taurus. Well, what about Saturn? Saturn reached opposition on April the 15th. That's when it's due south around midnight UT. And it's now seen about 20 degrees above the southeastern horizon after sunset in the constellation of Virgo, about 5 degrees above the first magnitude star Spica. It remains virtually in the same space in the sky during the month, as on the 26th of June, it halts its westward retrograde motion, that's due to the Earth coming round on the inside track, and begins to move eastwards. The magnitude is dropping as it gets further away from plus 0.5 to plus 0.7 in the month. And at the same time, of course, the angular size drops from about 18 to 17 arc seconds. Well, Mercury, we will see it this month. It has a fine after sunset apparition during the latter half of the month. It sets about 1.5 hours after the Sun, shining at magnitude zero. But you probably need to use binoculars to search for it. And don't begin to use those until the Sun has actually set. But perhaps be there around sunset to see where the Sun has set, and you'll know, looking up a little bit to the left, where to find Mercury. And there's a hint of also how to find it coming up in the highlights. Well, Mars, I mentioned, is lying below the body of Leo. It's past its best now. As it moves away, its magnitude fades from plus 0.5 to plus 0.8, moving, as I said, from Leo into Virgo on the 20th of June. The angular size is shrinking too, from about 8 arc seconds down to 6.6. So I'm afraid, unless you're on the top of Mauna Kea or something, you're not likely to see any surface markings. Well, Venus, we're going to come back to that, but it's at inferior junction on June the 6th. But you might just spot it along with Mercury, about 6 degrees above the northwestern horizon at the very beginning of June. By mid-June, it actually reappears in the pre-dawn sky and rises about half an hour before sunrise, when it's shining at magnitude about minus 4.1. It has a very thin crescent phase then, perhaps just 2% illuminated. As it pulls further away from the sun, we'll actually see it lying within the V-shaped Hyades cluster, close to the star Aldebaran in Taurus. Well, finally, what about the highlights this month? Well, let's start with one that you can see the whole month. The lovely things called noctilucent clouds. They're very high in the atmosphere, perhaps about 80 kilometers, and they're lit by the light from the sun low below the northern horizon. So you see them the northwest, the north, the northeast. They appear as bright whitish blue wisps, and they're most obvious, in fact, after midnight, so you need to stay up fairly late. They appear to be more prominent now than in the past, and in fact no one appears to have seen them before the mid-19th century. It's thought they may be associated with methane. There's now more methane in the atmosphere due to all sorts of reasons, cows being one of them. And that can disassociate into water vapour in the high atmosphere, allowing ice clouds to form around little dust particles, perhaps from meteorites coming in. So otherwise it would be too dry up there. So maybe that's why we see them. But do look out for them, preferably to the north of a town or city, because you won't have the light pollution to contend with. On the 1st of June, as I mentioned, Venus and Mercury will be just 12 arc minutes apart. So again, you could spot those. Don't use binoculars until after the sun has set. And on the 3rd and 4th of June, we have another supermoon. We had one last month, or mega moon, some people call it. It's when the moon is full, close to what is called perigee, when it's very close to the Earth, its closest. In fact, the orbit of the moon means that its angular size varies by about 12%, and that means the area that we see in the sky increases from when we see a full moon at apogee, furthest from the Earth, to perigee, by about 30%, so it can look quite good. And obviously, try and see it rising both of those nights, the 3rd and 4th, because if you do, you'll have a wonderful view of what's called the moon horizon, when it appears to be much larger, apparently to us, than when it's higher in the sky. We suspect this is because we perceive the dome of the heavens above us to be a flattened rather than a hemispherical dome. So when we see the moon on the horizon, we feel it's further away subconsciously, and that tends to make it rather bigger in our mind's eye. On June the 21st, we have Mercury. I said it was going to be visible this month, and it's going to be very close to a very thin crescent moon, and that always looks rather nice. And if you spot the moon, they'll both be low down again, so look after sunset, and don't observe with binoculars until after sunset, as I keep on saying. But you may well see on the unilluminated side of the moon what we call Earthshine. It's light reflected back from the surface of the Earth from clouds, which illuminates very faintly the part of the moon that's not illuminated by the sun, and that can look rather lovely. On the 29th of June, we have Venus. Remember I said it was down in the Hyades cluster? Well, that'll be below Jupiter in the pre-dawn sky. So perhaps that's something to end the month with. Well, we do have one real highlight this month, but not a lot of chance to see it, sadly. On the 6th of June, at dawn, we have the second and last transit of Venus this century. You typically get two transits of Venus separated by around 100 years or so, and they are 8 years apart. And the last one was in 2004. And we had a lovely view of that out at the observatory at Jodrell Bank. A picture I took there is actually on the night sky page of the Jodrell Bank website. The first contact, which is when the disk of Venus first touches the sun's limb, is at 11:10 BST. So it's nighttime, so we're not going to see much of the transit. And sadly, by the time the sun rises, the transit will be nearly over. You need to get up pretty early. Depending where you are, sunrise varies. From Edinburgh, it's 04:30. Leeds, 04:38. London, 04:46. Belfast, 04:51. And Cardiff, 04:58. So to see as much of the transit as possible, perhaps about the last half an hour or so, you want to be as far north and east as you can get. Anyway, a little bit about the history. It was Johann Kepler, remember he produced the laws of planetary motion. He was the first person to predict a transit of Venus, in fact that of the 6th of December 1631, but he wasn't accurate enough in his time to know whether or not it would be observed, and in fact it wasn't observed in Europe, so there's no evidence of anyone having seen it. Using Kepler's tables, Jeremiah Horrocks, a curate at the church of Much Hall in Lancashire, north of Preston, calculated that a transit would occur on November the 24th, 1639. And that's in the old calendar, by the way. He observed it, the latter past, and he also alerted a friend of his called William Crabtree, who observed it from Manchester. And in the town hall of Manchester, there's a wonderful mural showing Crabtree projecting the sun's image onto a white disc on the far side of his room. And that's the same way, of course, that actually Horrocks observed it too. It's believed they were the only two people to witness it. Edmund Halley, who was the second astronomer royal, realized that Venus transits could be used to measure the distance between the Earth and Venus, and hence, of course, that of the sun, to give what is called the astronomical unit. So the transits of Venus in 1761 and 1769 were observed across the world. Basically, you want to have observations in the south and in the north as far separated as possible, so that the path that Venus takes across the sun is slightly different. From the angular size between the two paths, you can actually measure the parallax and hence the distance of Venus and then the sun, because they're related by Kepler's third law. That's a very difficult measurement to make, and so it was decided they'd actually make measurements of the time when Venus just entered the whole of the sun's disk, so the whole of the disk of Venus was seen against the sun. So they wanted the time when that first happened, and then the time just before Venus left the whole of the sun's disk. The problem was that an effect called the black drop effect meant it was actually very hard to estimate those times. And I think when Cook observed it with his astronomer Green, that they disagreed by about 12 seconds in time. So the measurements weren't all that accurate. And as I mentioned Cook, that perhaps the most famous of those expeditions was when Captain Cook went to Tahiti in 1769 on his world cruise. When he finished the observations, he had to open sealed orders, and they said he should continue going around the globe to try and discover what they called the then unknown southern continent, Terra Australis Incognita. And Australis, of course, means southern, so the southern land that was unknown. And in fact, having spent some time charting New Zealand, and in fact I hope to be going to one of the places where he moored his boat and set up Observatory Point, where they made observations in the fjords of New Zealand just in a few days' time, he then went over and discovered the land that we now called New South Wales. Well, later on, in 1874, Australia and New Zealand were also prime locations at which to observe the transit, and this was the first time that photographic observations were made, and the results did in fact give a value of the astronomical unit not far off our modern value. And I might just point out that this is on the Jodrell Bank website, that one of the first precise measurements were made at Jodrell Bank by radar observing the planet Venus in the mid-60s. And in fact we, I have to say, along with the Americans and the Russians, all got a value that agreed very, very closely. So since then, we've known the astronomical unit with very high precision, and it's nice that Jodrell Bank was involved. Well, it is our last chance, this set tree, the last chance any of us will have of seeing it. So have a go. Let's hope it's clear. And of course, you must never look directly at the sun. One way that I've used in the past is to mount a very small pair of cheap binoculars, you know, the little handheld ones, at one end of a shoebox, sticking through from the outside, and project an image of the sun onto some white cardboard stuck on the inside of the opposite end of the box. And that actually works pretty well. You can, of course, buy eclipse glasses, and you can also buy special filters that you can put in front of a telescope. But obviously, never, ever look directly at the sun. Well, as I said, not many hours of darkness, but still one or two things to look for, and the very best of luck in hoping to observe the transit of Venus.
Thanks a lot, Ian. And now here's John Field with what you can see in the Southern Hemisphere night sky.
Kia ora, and welcome to the June Jodcast from Wellington, New Zealand. Whilst those in the Northern Hemisphere are hopefully enjoying the summer, we in the Southern Hemisphere are coping with the long nights and short days of our winter months. The highlight of June will have to be the transit of Venus, which will be the last for this century. On June the 6th, those facing towards the sun during the 6 hours of the transit will see the small black disk of Venus move slowly across the sun. A number of websites will be streaming a live view of the transit, so if you cannot see the sun, there will still be a chance to see it. The next transit is not until December 2117, so there will be a long wait. Fingers crossed for a clear day for all observers. June 20th marks the winter solstice here in the Southern Hemisphere. And in New Zealand, the dawn rising of the Matariki, Pleiades and Puanga, Rigel coincides with the winter solstice. These stars are used by Māori throughout the country to mark the changing of Te Maramataka, the Māori annual calendar. Our southeastern sky is dominated by the zodiac constellation of Scorpius, and following behind is Sagittarius the Archer. The red star Antares marks the heart of the Scorpion. This Arabic name means the rival of Mars. This red giant star is the 16th brightest in our night sky and is estimated to be 600 light years away. It has an estimated diameter 800 times greater than that of our Sun. Antares is a faint companion star that is difficult to observe in small telescopes. To Māori and some Polynesian cultures, Scorpius is seen as a fishing hook, a much more familiar item in the South Pacific. One of the Māori names of Antares is Rehua, and it marks the eye of the hook. Straddling the Milky Way, the region around Scorpius is home to a number of star clusters and nebulae which are easily observed. Nearby to Antares are two globular clusters, M4 and NGC 6144. The M prefix and number are from Charles Messier's catalogue of 110 comet-like objects published in 1771. NGC is a new general catalogue of 7,840 objects compiled by John Dreyer and published in 1895. Along the curved body of the Scorpion, there are a number of visual double stars that make a lovely sight to the unaided eye in binoculars or telescopes. Near the stinger of the Scorpion, we find a naked eye cluster of stars that appears like a comet. Called NGC 6231, this is a cluster of stars similar in size to the Pleiades, but further away at 6,000 light years. The stars in this cluster are much brighter than those in the Pleiades, and if placed at the same distance, they would shine as bright as Sirius, making a stunning sight in our night sky. Also nearby to the stinger, we find the star cluster M7. Appearing as a haze to the unaided eye, this cluster makes a nice view in binoculars or wide-field telescopes. Also in this region, but much fainter, is the butterfly cluster, M6, at a distance of 1,300 light-years away. The neighbouring constellation Sagittarius is host to a large number of nebulae, along with many open and globular star clusters. These range in size from large and bright to small and faint. The constellation represents an archer in Babylonian mythology, where it was seen as a multi-headed and multi-tailed centaur with wings and a bow, a rather scary sight. Perhaps the most spectacular clusters in the nebulae are the Lagoon and Trifid. The Lagoon nebula is also known as M8, and it gets its name as it appears in a compact cluster of stars surrounded by a circle of nebulosity with a dark rift. The western part of M8 is dominated by two bright stars of 6th magnitude. The eastern part has a loose cluster of stars. From studying the types of stars in the cluster, it is estimated that this is a young cluster. In this nebula, there are a large number of dark globules that are regions around forming protostars. At 4,000 to 6,000 light years away from our solar system, its dimensions are estimated at 110 by 50 light years. This is one of the few star-forming nebulae visible to the unaided eye. The Trifid or M20 is seen as a small region of nebulosity near to the lagoon. With a 200mm or greater telescope, it should be possible to spot the dark lanes that split the nebulosity into three sections. The brightest stars in Sagittarius form an asterism called the Teapot. Lambda Sagittarii marks the top of the Teapot and is nearby to the globular cluster M22. It is one of the brightest in our night sky and can be easily found with binoculars. M22 is also amongst the most massive in our galaxy and one of the closest to our solar system. It was described by Messier in 1764 as a nebula containing no stars. William Herschel's Beta telescope allowed it to become the first to resolve the individual stars in this cluster. This cluster should actually appear brighter in our night sky, but due to the intervening interstellar material between us and the cluster, it appears much fainter. Due to the improvement in the quality of optics available today, even small telescopes should be able to resolve individual stars in this cluster. M23, an open cluster 2,000 light years away, consists of over 100 stars being visible forming curving arcs and chains. M24 is a bright region of stars and is often called the Small Sagittarius Star Cloud. This cloud includes a number of dark nebulae superimposed on a brilliant starry background. M25 is a bright open cluster with a number of deep yellow stars and 2,000 light years away. M55 at magnitude 7.4 is a bright globular cluster 16,000 light years away, discovered in 1752. Binoculars will reveal it as a hazy star, and progressively larger telescopes reveal more and more stars. Surprisingly, there is a galaxy visible. NGC 6822, and known as Barnard's Galaxy, resides in the northeastern portion of the constellation. It is an irregular dwarf galaxy that is best viewed in a wide-field telescope. The Milky Way is at its brightest, widest, and densest in this region. It has been seen as a river, sky road, or a bridge between the heavens and earth. The Arabians call it Al-Nar, the river. The Chinese refer to it as the River of Heaven. To Māori, it was called Te Ikarawa, the long fish. Today we know it's the plane of our galaxy stretching around our sky. The region of Sagittarius is in the direction of the galactic centre, about 30,000 light years away. This region is known as Sagittarius Star A, and is where astronomers have detected a supermassive black hole. By watching the motion of the stars orbiting this region, astronomers estimate its mass is about 3 million times that of our Sun. Closer to home, we have the planets Mars and Saturn in our evening sky. Jupiter is in the morning sky rising before the Sun, and it will be joined by Venus at the end of the month. A lunar eclipse commences on the evening of June the 4th and ends on the morning of June the 5th, and this follows the annual eclipse of the Sun on May the 20th. Unlike the solar eclipse, which was central, the eclipse of the Moon will be partial with no more than 37% of the Moon's diameter in the umbral, that is, the complete shadow of the Earth. All stages of the eclipse are visible from New Zealand and most of Australia. In New Zealand, the eclipse commences at 8:48 p.m. and ends at 1:18 a.m. Maximum eclipse is at 11:03 p.m. We hope you have enjoyed our Jodcast and we wish you all clear skies.